Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Another spectacular day here in the eastern part of the country. Wonderful weather we're having. We have a great show lined up for you tonight. I have Father William Holtberg, better known as Father Bill. A lot of people know him. Let's get right to it. Father, thank you for being on the show.
Good to see you, Tom, or Todd.
That's great. We're really looking forward to hearing your story. Let's start right away. Tell us about your growing up, your earliest memories.
I came. You talk about dysfunctional families. I guess I kind of wrote the book. Every male member on my father's side was an alcoholic, from grandfather, father, five uncles, first cousins, second cousins, and I'm the only one in recovery. And I'm going on 81 right now, and I do reflect an awful lot too, particularly in the line of work I'm at, about the earliest days. And my early recollection, as I say, I'm 81, and man, dear, the memories of a dysfunctional childhood are very vivid. My father, I guess he was an alcoholic, and like any good alcoholic, he was unable to have a commitment to his family. I know when I was 18 months old, I'm told that he was responsible for the death of my mother. He likewise was having an affair with another woman when he was married to my mother, and as soon as she died, they got married, and together they just absolutely, they beat the living daylights out of me, to be honest. My earliest recollection is standing up in a courtroom in Wilmington, Delaware, and a judge taking my pants down, and I can remember him saying, "My God, who did this?" I was just black and blue, and he said, "Is that person in this courtroom? Would you point him out?" And I pointed to my stepmother, and I said, "My mommy." And I can still see her standing up there and shouting at me, "You GDSB, I'll kill you." I can still hear that gavel going down, and she was committed. We called them workhouses in those days, and she got 6 months in the workhouse. And I was made a ward of the state of Delaware, and in and out of 10 different foster homes and orphanages by the time I'm 3 to 4. I was very lucky. The Catholic Welfare Guild, Catholic Charities, took all the Catholic kids from the state and found Catholic foster homes for us, and I was very lucky. I got a good foster home in Hookes in Delaware, and by John and Margaret Stanisha, and they had three grown children of their own at that time, and she took in, I guess there were 10 of us from the Catholic Charities, and completely raised three of us from the time we were 4 years old. And it was tough times, and as I'm saying, that was Depression days, and I was born in 31, and by the time I got there, it was about 1935, and it was poor, and they had a farm, and we helped on the farm, and nothing abusive or anything like that. We just pitched in and fed the chickens and the cows, and and collected eggs and stuff like that, and hoed the garden, and worked around there, and we also went to school in Hokesson, and then my foster father got very sick, and they moved from the farm down to down there, Marshalton, Delaware, down there on the Limestone Road, and then we went to Marshalton School, and things were great. I remember my first taste of really death was when my foster father died in 1945. I guess the war was just coming to a close, and that was traumatic for us too. And but I can remember too, the war years were awful, and a lot of tension that would be going on in those days. And I can remember too, as I'm saying, from a very early age, like 8 or 9 years old, times are tough, and we had to get out and work. And I remember my foster brother Steve, he liked the farm and all that. I didn't like manual labor at all. So I went over, there was a golf course near us, and I loved it over there. I took up, even at an early age, I loved golf. I loved the people. I loved the environment. And and when, it was a very early age that And looking back on my life and telling my story, I think one of the landmarks in my story is the fact I remember about 8 or 9 years old and Caddy, and it was like, Bill, you can feel sorry for yourself because you're different from other kids, or you can make something of your life. And I can remember I got very friendly with a lot of the executives of the Hercules Powder Company. They used to ask me to caddy for them. And when you go around for 3 hours, they get to know you, and on a regular basis they would ask for me. And I can remember them talking to me, and I guess they fathered me to a good extent. And it was just a good learning experience. And I took a great delight in going to people again who were successful. Mm-hmm. And I knew if I was ever going to make something of my life, it was going to be because of me. And don't forget, times were tough in those days. And people had to work for every doggone thing that they had. And we helped out with one another. And also, when we got into high school, the Catholic welfare, again, was awesome. And I'm just so grateful to the Catholic Church at that time for giving us and supporting us in a good foster home. And that's when I came in contact with a group of priests that just absolutely blew me out of the water. It was the Oblates of St. Francis de Sales. For those of you who are in Allentown, we have de Sales University. Yes. Over in Center Valley over there. And I know most of the priests over there, but this was during the war. War had just ended in 49 is when I became a freshman at Salesianum. And immediately I just saw them as somebody very special. Let me back up just a little bit. So when I was 4 years old, and we went out to Hocus, Delaware, and on the farm, we went to an old country church. I'll never forget the first time I went into this old, dilapidated Catholic church, and all the farmers and people were there. There was something very special. That was my first contact with God. And I just felt everything was going to be okay. You know, I just felt at peace and secure in that church with all the people. And in those days, too, it is, as I think, the Depression, and we helped one another and whatnot. And I can remember in times for the harvest, we would help the farmers. We'd all get together and do one farm, then move to the next and whatnot. And I'll never forget one incident. They had big lunches, big dinners there for them. And I remember we had some black folks there, and they wanted to sit out in the kitchen. And my foster parents says, "No way. You know, no way, you will sit around the table with us." And the very next morning, we had a cross burned on our front lawn. The KK didn't seem to. That was my first experience with prejudice and the violent and the people, again, who were hate-filled. And then I just saw my foster family was just instilling in us the virtue of everybody is God's children. And the second value was that we help one another. You know, and it was an awesome community. And they were the early lessons I learned that, you know, you ask for help, you get it. And also, too, when other people ask for help, you give it. Mm-hmm. And it was a great, big, beautiful family in those days. But again, back to Salesianum High School in Wilmington at 8th and West. The thing that hit me, and we came in from Hocus, and then guys, it was about 15 or 20 miles. We hitchhiked back and forth every day. And I can remember to save 8 cents on car fare or what. We would walk from 8th and West to Silverbrook Cemetery, and usually we got a decent ride in every day. We were never late. People just got to know us, and they pick us up and take us there. Yeah. And same thing going home, too. So it wasn't really that bad. When the rain was a little difficult, but we managed it. We never thought anything of it. But again, as I'd walk and we'd see our priest when I were coming to school in the morning, see our priest coming from all four corners of north, south, east, and west, walking back from saying early masses at some of the parishes. And you just begin to see that they were men who loved who they were and they loved what they did. They loved being priests and they loved the work that they did. And they were just awesome. They were our teachers, disciplinarians. They were our my football, basketball, golf coach, spiritual directors, confessors, and mentors and stuff like that. And I really got to love them, you know. And I began to get the seeds of a vocation. I want to, man, there's something in these people that I like, and I like what they're doing. But I liked, it was obvious they liked who they were, and maybe I could become like they were and do what they did. And then it come time for graduation, and again, as I'm saying, I thought about it. I always rejected the notion of the priesthood because, again, well, you know, you're kind of a nobody, and you don't have your own family, and who do you belong to, and stuff that you're not worthy, and so I just put that out of my mind for a while, and. I had a good offer from the Hercules Powder Company, you know, the golf course and the people. But I had no problem when I graduated. I think I was one of two. Times were tough in those days. I think I was one or two high school students that they hired in the company, and I worked in the mailroom. And then I expected to spend the rest of my life there with the Hercules Powder Company and then move on up and go to night school to get some education and whatnot there. So. I guess it was around October. That was June I started working all through the summer. It was great. And then in October, I got an invitation from one of my classmates who had joined the Oblates to his religious reception. And I went for some reason. I remember I was standing up in the balcony there, and I was looking down on them receiving their, you know, their cassocks and collars and cinctures and the religious garb and whatnot. And something just said to me, you belong down there. I remember the priest standing next to me, said to me, he looked over, he said, Bill, we always thought that you'd be one of us. And it was just like a jolt. And I said, Father, I always thought so, but I don't have any money for college and any of this stuff. And I know my foster family can't afford anything like this. He said, you don't need any of that. We'll take care of you. And wow. And so I decided then to leave the Hercules and joined the Oblates and went into the novitiate for a year. And I did. I spent 4 years within the Oblates. And I went to college up at Niagara University and always thought I was pretty dumb in school. I really had to work for everything I got. And I just, you know, I just made C's, and that was about a C average student and really had to work. But I took all the harder courses. And when I hit college, you know, the tests weren't too good. They said your chances of surviving are pretty minimal. So, but again, we just worked together, and I asked for help. And the first 2 years, I made the honor roll and nice. And whatnot. But then the Korean War broke out, and this was about 1951 or 52, and. I began to have some doubts. Of course, I was just turning 20, 21 and going into early manhood. And it was really some stuff, some life, you know, the questioning some stuff. Do I continue? I was up for perpetual vows. And I'm at 21. I said, gee, I don't know whether I'm ready for this, you know. And I said, I never had anything, never had a family. And maybe, you know, we kind of like to get married and have a family of my own. And whatnot, and so I remember talking over with my spiritual director and the provincial, the Oblates, and I said, Father, I just don't think I'm quite ready to make that commitment for life. I said, Bill, we don't think so either. But look, if you want to leave, go take a leave of absence, keep in touch, and if you ever want to come back, you're more than welcome. So I did. I took a leave of absence, and the Korean War was just ending in those days, and immediately was drafted, and I took basic at Leonard Wood. I literally grew up, you know, my first adult experiences were in the military. You know, I was on my own and not making much money, you know, in those days. The basic pay was about $60 for privates a month and whatnot, but I literally grew up. I remember I had my first drinking in the military and 3-2 beer, and I began to wonder why I was... When I started drinking at the post exchange, everybody else was quitting, and I said, "This stuff's not doing anything for me at all." And whatnot. But I finished basic at Leonard Wood, and then was went out to Fort Lewis and to be embarked for overseas in Japan. I spent 18 months in Japan in the 53 and 54, and part of 55 came back. And that was really an experience. I was stationed down at Ajima, down near Hiroshima, the old Japanese Naval Academy down there, and the Army had assigned me as a personal management specialist, and got to, again, just really got to love the military, and the experience was unbelievable. Remember, we took a fishing boat from Special Services up to Hiroshima where the bomb went off. It wasn't too far away. And I remember I went to Mass on a Sunday night. The rest of the guys were in the hotel sleeping, and I found a cathedral there, and I went to Mass, and I stuck out like a sore thumb. And in my military, of course, we had to wear uniforms a lot of times in those days. And then the priest came down, and he said, would you like to have breakfast with us? And I said, yes, Father. It was Father LaSalle. He was a Jesuit missionary to Japan, and he had survived the atom bomb blast. And we got talking, and he said, do you have any of your friends? I said, yeah, they're sleeping at the motel or hotel. Go back and get them. So they took us on a tour of the city, and I'll tell you, it was an eye-opener. And saw where the bomb went off, the damage, and some of the, you know, it was almost like people imprinted right into the cement there, and there wasn't a tree available. And it shook me. You know, it was about 8 years after the bomb did go off. And then he said, why don't you take, if you're looking for some stuff, he said, go to the religious island at Miyajima. And we took another week up there, and the fishing boat, another religious experience there with the, and I can remember just watching the Japanese people, their rituals at their shrines and whatnot. And I remember the first thing that hit me is this, I can't believe that these people are going to hell because they don't believe like I believe. And that imprinted on me, and again for my future ministry too, I think so. But anyway, I came back from Japan, and I know I went to visit the provincial of the Oblates. He says, "Here." I said, "No, Father, I'd like to do one more thing on my own, and that is to finish college." And we had the GI Bill in those days, so that's what I did. And I got a part-time job in a clothing store. Listen to this, if times have changed. Minimum wage was 85 cents an hour, you know, and my GI Bill was $125 a month, which I was living off. And I paid LaSalle College $65 a month tuition.
Wow.
Okay? Times have changed, but we survived, and that's how we lived. But again, my drinking, again, that sort of progressed, but it was still, my drinking was, I guess, was tampered by my pocketbook. I just couldn't afford an awful lot of it. So, but after that, I went back and I decided after I graduated, decided to go back into the Oblates. And that was 1957, and taught for a year in Detroit, and then went back and began theology studies at Catholic University down in Washington, and ordained in 1962. And by this time, my foster mother had died a year before ordination, and that was quite sad. And again, I just... I was just so grateful to that family, and of course the rest of that family, her children were like my older brothers and sisters, and they did everything for my first Mass, the reception in there, and just like family. And then again, it was I remember right after ordination thinking, my God has answered my prayer, and my dream was, you know, I wanted to be just like these men. I loved, you know, they loved who they were, and they loved what they did, and I wanted to be like them, and I did. And I guess my first teaching experiences was at North Catholic in Philadelphia. In those days, we had gigantic enrollments, like 5,000 at North Catholic and 5,000 up at Father Judge and whatnot. And I got a good taste of why priests don't marry. And, you know, we were up every morning and saying an early Mass at one of the parishes, and back to the faculty house, getting breakfast, and then over to school, teaching six classes. And then, of course, I was athletics. I was football, basketball, and golf in the coaching stuff there. And then right after school, you'd hit the athletic room, and you'd get the kids through practices, and then close up the athletic room back to the faculty house, grab some supper, get back to the room, and correct papers and prepare classes and things like that. So it was a full schedule. I mean, we became really workaholics. One thing again is my drinking escalated at that point. And I didn't even hit me. And what?
How old were you then, Bill? Excuse me.
I was probably in my early. No, I guess I was 31 or 32 when I was ordained. I'm 81 now, so I'll have 50 years this coming June as my 50 years as a priest. So figure that whatever it was. But anyway. I absolutely loved what I was doing, teaching the kids, and then the sports, being with the kids in football, basketball, and then the golf coach. And I remember too, we went every Saturday. We would hear confessions from 3 to 5, 7 to 9. Say 3 masses on Sunday. Back to the faculty house, and usually had a Sunday afternoon basketball game or whatnot. And so it was full.
But I got to ask you a couple of questions, okay? Before we go, I just because this, I've been listening and I'm fascinated. But you said things like, your dream. I mean, most of this is being able to look back. I mean, when you were like 9, when those things were being imprinted on you, and those other memories. I mean, did you really? It sounds to me like your heart was tugging on you a long time, even when you were in that balcony. Like, you know, you knew what you were supposed to be doing, kind of.
Yeah, I did, but I never thought I was good enough or to have the money to do all this stuff. I didn't ask the right questions.
Oh, there you go. And also, I heard your doubts, too. You doubt yourself, those negative voices in our heads, you know, that I can't do it.
Oh, you better believe it. Yeah, it's not, I'm not good enough, I'm not holy enough to be a priest and all this. And by the way, that was my when I was teaching out in Detroit as a scholastic before ordination. Yeah, we had to do 2 years practice teaching to see if we're going to, because we're a teaching order. And if you didn't, then they would say, well, maybe you need to go to maybe the seculars or parish ministry or something like that now. And but I can remember talking to my spiritual guide out in Detroit and saying, you know, Father, he said, I don't know whether I want to go through with this. I don't see myself as pious or, and all this stuff. And he looked at me and I said, you know, I just don't know whether I want to go on or I'm worthy to go. He looked at me and he said, Bill, he said, if you think for 1 minute God chose you because of your good points, you're crazy. You know, God chose you because of your weaknesses, you know, and whatnot, which can become your strengths. And again, it will be you overcoming your weaknesses will see with compassion the weaknesses of other people out there, and you're going to treat them as Christ treated them, you know. And that's made sense to me on that. And so I said, okay, so you're going to get what you see here, and I may not be the holiest and whatnot. But
it's funny we need someone else. It's funny we need someone else to tell us that. You know what I mean? Like
I know.
You know, it's always that way.
We get the idea that we've got to be, no temptations, no sin. You've got to be just so pious and whatnot. And that's not true. Huh. You know, in St. Francis de Sales, he says, be who you are, but be it well. Mm-hmm. That's what St. Francis de Sales said. You know, be who you are, but be it well. Whatever station in life you are, just be what you are. And that's where you're going to work out your sanctity and your holiness here and, your purpose in living there. So. But it was that second year at North Catholic, I guess, we had a basketball coach that I was very friendly with. And I remember after one basketball game, we stopped for dinner one time, and he said, Father, he said, the Vietnam War was just beginning at that time. And he said, I got my Marines down at the Navy Yard. He was a reservist at the time. And he said, why don't you get a commission and come on down and work for us? I said, Charlie, I had my time in the military. No thanks. And don't ask me why, but he asked me again, and that was sticking behind my mind, too, that, I had really liked the military and whatnot. The Vietnam War was going there, and so I said to Charlie, I said, I'll give it a try. I'll talk to the provincial. I doubt if they're going to let me go because we're short of priests and all this. And the provincial said, yeah, get a reserve commission. You can't go active. but get a reserve commission and just get, you know, still teach and do you there and on the side do the military thing. So I was commissioned on the 26th of June 1965 as a Lieutenant JG in the Naval Reserve and immediately moved to to our Catholic high school in Niagara Falls, New York, Bishop Duffy. And don't ask me why, I always loved the kids that nobody else wanted. You know, the kids who thought that they were dumb, the hellraisers of the school. They're the ones I usually, that were attracted to me, and I was attracted to them. Don't ask me why, but and so I ended up teaching. You know, in those days, we separated the A, B, and C, senior A, B, and C, and D, or senior 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the fourth were usually the losers that drifted down, that you know, but they're the ones I taught. And I was going to the reserves up in Buffalo, New York, and they got very active in the reserves up there. And of course, my kids were not going to, their marks were not good enough. They weren't getting into college in those days. And if you didn't get into college, you were drafted. And sure enough, my senior four kids were going in, and then they asked me to swear them in. And, you know, there's pictures in the Niagara Falls paper, me swearing in a group of our high school kids, going to the Marine Corps, a lot of them. And sure enough, they're over in the NOM, I'm getting letters, and when they come home on leave, we get together in their basement, and you know, we do a lot of drinking, but and talking. They said, Father Bill, we need you over there. So don't ask me why I got permission to go active in July of 68, and my first tour was in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I know exactly when they're talking about Gitmo right now, where all the prisoners are down there. That was the area, I think, where the 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines were. And I remember I used to ride the fence from Castro, you know, separating us from them, and talk to the Marines in the fighting holes there at night. And that's where I began to get some experiences about what was going on in Vietnam. So I did volunteer to get to the NOM, and the and sure enough, my second tour was 69 and 70 was Vietnam. If you saw the movie Full Metal Jacket, I picked that battalion up right. Yeah, after they moved, I guess sometime later they had moved from way down to south of Da Nang, and I picked that battalion up right after that. And I saw nothing compared to what that Marine Corps grunt saw, nothing. But I saw just enough to screw me up, the death, the dying, the horrors of war, and the poverty of the people, how it impacted on the civilians. And, you know, I just shook my head and saying, my God, this is awful, you know. And I did get the idea, too, that... you know, I went over this complete hawk and came back as pretty dovish. And, you know, and I saw the I saw some of the logic in the war protesters. And by the way, I took a look at the 60s as probably one of the greatest events in that 100 year, in that century. The colleges were alive. The kids were alive. They were challenging everything and everybody, and it needed to be challenged. Mm-hmm. There was a different culture breaking down, the kids were really coming alive and asking some good questions. And they were tired of the materialism. Then you got your hippies and your freaky people and all that, and your love children. But you know, I look back and see now is where my God, the drug scene destroyed that. You know, it was just a shame that the drug scene entered that, and it destroyed a very movement that could have been so great. And it just bothered me to no end. And I remember when I came back from Vietnam, I said I was a mess, really a mess. We knew nothing about post-trauma in those days. Right. And I didn't think I saw, you know, the Marines saw... You know, I saw nothing compared with these guys. But again, as I say, enough. The dead bodies. I still don't handle death, dying, funerals, and attending the dying. There's a block there. It's just I shut it out, and the body bags, and If you ever saw the MASH, that's real, by the way. I remember the battalion aid station back in there, and when that siren would go off, the choppers would fly in, you know, go get into there, and they'd start anointing the dead, anointing the wounded, and whatnot on that. So, but I came back, nightmares, shakes, and my drinking escalated over there and here.
Were you doubting yourself then? Were there doubts going on then, too? I mean, were you always questioning yourself or not?
I wasn't really questioning myself. I was questioning... I was questioning the war. I was questioning society, and I guess, to be very honest with you, I was siding with the probably with the hippies and the freaky people and the kids. I loved the kids coming alive on the college campuses.
Yeah.
You know, challenging our thinking and whatnot. I said, my God, these kids are alive, and it's going to be a different generation that they're going to bring peace, and they're going to, you know, not so much materialism after like the period of the 50s. If you saw The Graduate, that movie, that was a transitional film. You know, where the people coming back from the Second World War and us who in the Depression. My kids are going to have it. They're not going through this crap. And they worked to give their kids everything. Yeah. And the kids took. The parents gave. And all of a sudden, you know, they began to wake up and say, you know, we're tired of this materialism. It's just not working for us.
And, I think what my question was, were you questioning God?
That's I remember not, in Vietnam I did.
Yeah, that's
yeah. In Vietnam I did. Yeah, I remember I had about 9 Marines coming to me for a general confession, and I said, "Well, why do you want to make a general confession, Father? I don't think I'm going to make it." And that kind of blew me. And I can remember all the casualty reports went over my desk, and I'm looking at it, and I said, "Oh my God, there's 9 right in a row." And I said, I said, dear God, how can you be doing that? Then it hit me, you know, and then it hit me. And this is how I resolved that. It was the fact is Almighty God was preparing them for death. And what looked like a disaster was reality, was the reality is that he was preparing them for heaven. So I kind of resolved the stuff there. I guess I got more angry at the politicians at that particular times and whatnot. So there. But again, my tour back was the Naval Air Station, Lemoore, California, and I came back a mess. And we knew nothing in post trauma those days. And my Navy doctor my drug pusher was a Navy doctor with a prescription pad, you know, second all Nebutol, 2-and-all, anything at all. And, I'm drinking on that stuff. And, man, I was going fast. Yeah. I hadn't the faintest idea what was happening to me, except I guess I wasn't back a month when I was at the officer's club for a hail and farewell party. And, I think I drank that much and whatnot. But I remember... going home, no sooner did I pull off the military base on the California highway, and I was pulled over by a California highway patrolman, and I blew 289 on the Richter scale, blood alcohol. And I can remember being humiliated and saying, oh, my God, you know, my military career's over. What's going on? I remember the commanding officer gave me a call the next morning. He said, Father, here, you got a DWI last night. I said, yes, sir, and my resignation will be on your desk anytime you want it. He says, what the hell are you talking about, Father? We all get them out there. And they did. Yeah. We did. Vietnam was so awful, and we were all into either the drug kids were into the drugs or drinking or something like that. But I lasted about another year. The second thing that hit me, because again, the more I learned, look back in my own story, I learned more about the addiction and what it does to you. And I remember it, you know, the whole thing, what you believe about addiction is going to determine how we're going to treat it. And the bottom line, it's a spiritual disease. It destroys your soul, the capacity to love and be loved, to have any relationships with anybody or anything, even God, you know. It just disconnects you from every relationship. And I remember I was saying Mass one morning, and I did everything a priest should do. I said my office, rosary, meditated, It said Mass every morning and whatnot. I remember I just said Mass, and I stood there and stopped, and I said, you know, something is wrong with me. I don't feel connected with the ritual. The most beautiful part is the holy sacrifice of the Mass here, and I just performed it, and I am not connected. I went through a ritual, but I am not connected with God or anything. I just have no connection. Then I said, well, there's got to be something wrong with me. So maybe if I said Mass a little bit more slowly, with a little bit pious and whatnot, and if one rosary was great, five rosaries would better, you know. And here I am now beginning to use religion addictively. More is better, you know, and still nothing was happening. So again, I had just reached a point in after that 1 year there, and I took the geographical cure. You know, there's something wrong. I don't know what's wrong. But I do need, no, I can't go on here. I need to run. So I resigned my Navy commission, went back to the order. I'm still in the state, probably in the middle stages of addiction. Went back and went back to Niagara Falls, back to all my senior four kids were back now, and we were getting together. I was a tight knit. They were my kids. You know,
yeah.
You get one class you just fit it in with them. You know, there are about 30 of them. And I was drinking with them. They were drinking. They were all PTSD. And, and we didn't know what was going on with us,
right.
You know. And I can remember I was going to Niagara University getting my master's degree. That was the excuse they used to get back. If I didn't finish my master's work at that time, I'd lose all my credits. That was my excuse. And when, so I went back, and within a year, I had finished my master's work at Niagara and got a degree in guidance and education. And I remember sitting there taking a three-hour course and a three-hour written exam, and I couldn't tell you what I did. It was like a blackout. But all I know is I ended up with a very high marks and did very well and got my master's degree. And then I was transferred down to one of our high schools in Alexandria, Virginia, Bishop Ireton down there. And I can remember my drinking was escalating all the time and shaking, beginning of the shakes and whatnot. I still had not a clue what the name of God was going on with me. No, and we just didn't have any. These were the 60s and early 70s. It wasn't until probably the 70 on, from about 73 or 70, where Senator Harold Hughes passed that legislation, is when the field really took off in 70 sometime. And I remember down there, I remember I walked into the school, and the principal said, "Boy, we're glad to see you here." I said, "Bob, what job do you have me for me?" He said, "We're going to make you the Dean of Men." I said, "The dean of what?" You know, it's a fancy title for the school disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I can remember I'm still drinking and heavy and whatnot, and it was a nightmare. That first year there, because again, I had been out of the classroom teaching for about 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and I can remember when I had left the Catholic high school in Niagara Falls. Our kids were still in shirts, ties, and coats. And here they're coming in now with torn jeans and tank tops and hair down to their backside. And it was, "Hey, man, this," and "Hey, man, that." And they're openly smoking in the bathrooms. And you couldn't, you know, and smoking pot out there. And I'm going crazy trying to control all this stuff. And my drinking is escalating.
Meantime, you're drunk and you're helping them
and
out.
Right. And there. So the interesting thing was I said Mass at Fort Belvoir one Sunday. I came back, and I remember it was June of 73. I remember I came back, summer school was out, and I can remember sitting down with a scotch and water and looking at a ball game, and I woke up 3 days later, mm-hmm. and all I was, I remember drinking, passing out, coming to, and I went through about a half a gallon. I remember I can't leave my room because I can't let the other priests see me drunk here. And I didn't eat. And I remember I was supposed to be at my foster sister's for supper up in Wilmington. And I remember about a Wednesday, I crawled out of the room and got to the phone, and I said, "Peg, I missed last night. I'm sorry." She says, "What's wrong with you?" And I stopped. I said, "Peg, I've been on a three-day drunk, and I can't stop." She says, "You get home here right away." So I drove from Bishop Ireton and Alexandria back to Wilmington. They took one look at me and took me to the family doctor, and they admitted me to St. Francis Hospital. And therefore, I was going through the DTs and the whole blasted thing. And I can remember I laugh about it now, but, father can't be an alcoholic. We've got to give him another a diagnosis, and it was gastrointestinal. So I'm looking back now, but that was the thinking. It was a disgrace for a priest to be
absolutely. But you really didn't know. I mean, you really didn't
I had the faintest idea at that time.
Until you did, right?
Yeah, my provincial came up and said to me, he said, "Bill," he said, "we think he got a problem with alcohol." And I said, I "think I do too, Father." And he said, "You know, we got a place in Warnersville, our retreat house, and right across the street there's a place where they treat drunks. It's called the Chit Chat Farms or Karen, and we'd like to send you up there." And, I may be an alcoholic, but I wasn't dumb. And I knew the easy way to get people off your back is to agree with them. So I said, "Okay, I will." So remember, July the 4th, 73, I pulled up and sat in the parking lot over there. And I just sat there for an hour saying, "How in the hell did I ever end up in a place like this? You know, a disgrace to the priesthood. What are these people going to think of me when they find out that I'm a priest? You know, I'm just a disgrace." And I can remember there were only about 35 of us at that time here, and in Chit Chat, it was an experience that really altered my life. And the one thing they kept telling me is, you're not a disgrace. You got a disease.
Right.
Addiction is not a disgrace. It's a disease. And they hammer that. By this time, Senator Harold Hughes too is beginning to, and some publicity coming out of this stuff. And it made sense to me, and I left there, went back, and believe it or not, I was taking some graduate work at the University of Virginia to be certified as the guidance director. We needed so many continuing education credits there, and I remember we were switching to a new system of education, as education without classrooms. It was all learning guides and resource centers, and you know, you get the kids assignments, they do them, they come up, you correct them. It was an individual kind of thing. And I remember for one of the papers I had to work for one of the graduate courses I was taking, and I wrote a high school course on addiction using learning guides and resources, and you'd send to the kids, you were to observe this film, then come back and discuss it and whatnot. And I got a call from somebody over there at the university. They said, "Father, you realize what you got here?" I said, "No." He said, "It's never been done here. Can you teach this?" I went back and I got to the principal and our people. They said, "Well, why not? You know, you can make it an elective and cross-credit it in health." And it was a course in alcohol use and abuse. And I'll never forget the first registration for the course. We had 500 kids, half the school signed up for it. And here I am, newly back in recovery, going to AA, and here I am now working, becoming a workaholic, and whatnot. And I can remember the kids coming to me, and I said to them, "Oh, I had an individual session with each one of them. If they took the course, they had to have an individual course, and they had to sit down with me for a one-on-one evaluation. They were to tell me what they were using and what it did to them." And I said to the kids, "You know, I'll tell you one of three things. You know, I'd prefer you not to use, but if you choose to use, let me know." And I'd say, "No, you're using, no problems, you know, or you're drinking alcoholically and you're drugging addictively. You're on your way. If you do not change that behavior, you're going down the tubes." And the third thing is, if I, through all my knowledge now that I was gaining from addiction, if I decide you're an addict, you're into the addiction, I have no choice. Call your parents and we'll get you up to treatment. And sure, I remember calling John Flannery up here at Chit Chat, and we were the first place to take adolescents here. you know, all the professional people were saying, kids are too young to be drunks, you know, you're full of crap. And, but I said, they're shaking to pieces. They got the physical dynamic. Oh, they're too young, you know, it's all in their head. And I called Flannery, and I said, Flannery, what'd I do with them? You know, you got a 15-year-old kid up here, you know. He said, send them up, we'll put them in with the kids. And I said, I had 26 up there in the 3 years, I think, that I had the course. And then I, you know, they would send them back to me and whatnot. But we were doing, you know, really great work. And this time I was getting on the speaking tour. You talk about not taking care of myself, you know.
Right.
And whatnot. And I remember one conference down there to clergy on alcohol use and abuse in Northern Virginia. And there must have been 150 clergymen in this place. Significant. I was the only Catholic priest there. And there were two Navy officers sitting in there, and my eyes picked them up. One was a four-striper, and the other was a three-striper, Navy captain and a Navy commander. And I knew that they were line officers and not chaplains. And so afterwards, after I gave they came up to me and said, Father, we heard what you were doing over at Bishop Ireton, and we're just beginning to write our program for the services, for the Navy. And we're trying to get a program for our young recruits, and you're the only one doing anything in the field, and we're going to get your kids. When they graduate, they're going to come into the Navy, and you know, we need to know what's going on with them. Can we come over and sit in with you and learn something? And I said, oh, my God, you people are a godsend, because I had no money, you know. They brought over films and stuff like that. They were sitting in and helping me do things like this. And then I did an article for the Washington paper, and I can remember all hell broke loose because I was beginning to talk about the addiction in our high schools and what we were doing to treat it. All hell broke loose in that school. If you know anything about Northern Virginia, they are so conservative, they are to the right of Attila the Hun down there, you know. And,
hey, I'm from Lancaster County, Bill, so, you know, I know a little bit about conservatives.
Yeah. Right. And no open mind at all. We're not paying $3,000 a year to send our kids to a school, Catholic high school, with full of drunks and dope addicts and whatnot. They were beginning to pull the kids out. I can remember Commander Bunn was sitting in my office at the time, and the phone was ringing off the hook of them pulling their kids out. I said, Jerry, I got to go, you know. You know, they're pulling these kids out left and right, and the tuition and whatnot to operate. You know, the name of the school is going down here. I said, I've got to go. I know the oblates won't tell me to stop what I'm doing, okay? But but I'm smart enough to know too that I'll destroy the school at this point if I don't go. He says, why don't you get your commission back and come work for us? We're going to open up a treatment facility in Norfolk. Remember, I called the chief of chaplains over at the Pentagon, and he said, Father, he said, he said, the greater need right now is the Army, and we'd love to have you back, but the greater need, and we're asking you, we're going to set up an appointment with the Army chief of chaplains for you. And I did, and I went there, and because I had Army experience too, that didn't bother me at all. Remember, I walked into the chief of chaplain's office, and I said, General, you're not going to touch me with a 10-foot pole. Here, I'm 43 years old. I'm a recovering alcoholic and whatnot. And he said, don't be too sure about that, Father. He had all my Navy records from sitting on his desk from Vietnam and my Navy experience. And he said, we kind of think we would like to have you back. And within a month, I was recommissioned in the Army. And then my first tour, I guess, was in Fort Bliss with the training brigade. And I'll never forget that. Of course, I'm gung-ho right now. I got to back up a little bit here. I got to back up. Yeah, I did relapse. I did relapse, but I was still teaching the course and still there. But I ended up back in detox in 75 Halloween, and the kids heard about it, and my kids used to sneak up into detox to see me, and I'll never forget that. Father, when you come back, we'll take care of you. we'll get you to meetings and and all this. You talk about it just touched me so much. The
Absolutely.
Kids, they just loved me that much. And
how'd you sort through that, like shame and all that? What are they going to think of that one?
It was an awful lot, but I went back and I just faced it, you know. And
good.
I said, I relapsed it, and it's a relapsable. But I learned. I said, I'm taking care of you, not taking care of myself.
Yeah, right.
Okay?
Right.
And so again, it was right after that happened. I guess it was a year later that, and I'm back, and the kids were taking care of me. They're coming back from Karen. I started a. I wouldn't let them eat in the lunchroom. They brought a brown bag lunch, and they come to guidance off. We'd have an AA meeting, a brown bag AA meeting, every noontime in my office or in the guidance there. And that's how the kids were doing. And I remember telling one kid, I've got kids now with 37 years recovery, you know, and one of my kids I had to expel from Bishop Ireton down there because he just wasn't hacking it. I said, Jimmy, get over to community college, you know, and I said, they have, if you complete your first year, they'll give you a GED. And I said, you're not making it here, you know, and you're back with that whole crowd again. And he did. That kid now is the director of adult education in Fairfax County, Virginia, and he's got about 37 years recovery. And the second kid came out of there was John H. He came back. I diagnosed him, got him up here, came back, and he finished Ireton, but he is now the owner of a construction company down there with 37 years of recovery. So a lot of our kids were really making it that I didn't even know about until later. So, but it was after this time that I said I did get back into the military.
Right,
In there, and Fort Bliss was another training brigade out there, and this was the 76, 77, somewhere in that area, and post Vietnam, and the kids were coming in they were picking up a lot of kids coming in with drug problems, and I remember I was doing a lot of lecturing, and of course, like I was an advocate for addiction and recovery, and I'm not quite an AA Nazi or anything like that. But I remember one day on the drill field, watching the senior drill sergeant with the troops, and I'm standing next to the skipper, the commanding officer, and I said, "Skipper, take a look at your senior drill sergeant. What do you notice? Pretty nervous out there, Father." I said, "Nervous hells." I said, "He is into withdrawals, you know."
Yep.
And we called the senior drill sergeant in, and I'm sitting there with the commanding officer, and we confronted him and say, "Yeah, you know, senior drill sergeant, we're kind of concerned about your health, and it looks like you're drinking a little too much. You've got some withdrawals." In those days, if the drill sergeants had going into treatment, they would have lost their hat. Their careers would have been over. So the commanding officer said to me, he said, "Father, how do we keep the senior, how do we deal with this?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Sir," I said, "let me contact the chief of psychiatry or somebody up in the medical field up there." I said, "There's a club down here in El Paso that's open from like 7 o'clock in the morning till midnight." And I said, we can get him, if he's not too far gone, and we can get a medical kind of an evaluation here, have him report down there, and we'll detox him on the hoof. So that's how that's what we did down there. And the commanding officer gave him an order to report to me, and I would take medicine down to him twice a day, and for about 10 days until they got over it, and then they'd start making meetings in those days, and then the word spread. I don't know how many drill sergeants we got into treatment, but I could do no wrong. You know, I could do no. The fact they made me when I left an honorary drill sergeant. So, but then something happened. I got orders for Korea. And I remember I was in touch with Commander Bunn out on the West Coast. The Navy had just started their training program out there. I said, "Jerry," I said, "I got orders for Korea." And I said, "If I'm going to work in there, I'm going to need some training. I have no training in this stuff." And he says, "Well, why don't you get TDY orders and come out here? And normally we don't take officers. Just gunnery sergeant, chief naval petty officers and whatnot here who are 2 years in recovery to be therapists. We'll train them for 4 months." And so again, he called the chief of chaplains saying there would be a slot available. I requested it and got a four-month delay in orders over to Korea to attend there. That was probably one of the most, intense, or how do I put it? It was one of the best experiences I've ever had. I remember we said there were about 33 of us that entered. I was the only officer. Most of them were chief petty officers, Navy, and probably gunnery sergeants, master gunnery sergeants, Marines. And all had 2 years recovery at that time. And I remember the opening remarks for the commanding officer said, there are 33 of you here. You know, by the time we're done with you, we will have deselected over one half of this class. Okay? They were tough. And I can remember we had group therapy. We had 2 hours a day, 5 days a week for 16 weeks. And we kept saying, we don't need all this head stuff, you know, and said, we were into recovery. We got good AA programs. Yeah. And the Navy's philosophy was this, you know, you can only take your clients as far as you are in your. If you're sicker than the people you're working with, you ain't going to take them nowhere. Two sickies don't make a welly, you know.
Yeah.
So I can remember every Friday they would come in and boom, you know. We don't think you're well enough. You're making enough problem. We're not going to turn you loose on any patient. Well, 13 of us survived anyway. And immediately I went to Korea. And it was awesome, that Navy program. Jesus, it was. I look back on that. It was wow. It was just absolutely awesome. And I remember I went to Korea, and I was assigned up the 2nd Division right up in the DMZ. And I can remember I was going through the hospital in Yongsan over there, and I remember one of the doctors came up to me, or the psychiatrist saw me, said, you're Holtberg, we heard about you. We want you down here to work in the drug and alcohol field. I said, sir, I got orders for a 2nd Division up there. Well, we're going to call the general up there and see if you can get. They did. They called the general if they could release me. The general said, hell, if he's that good, we're going to keep him. So I remember I walked in, and the general called me into his office, and he said, you were to report directly to me, right? But I said, what about the chain of command? He said, the hell with the chain of command, chaplain. And they said, I want you to spread 12-step program throughout this whole 2nd Division all the way up to the DMZ. Mm-hmm. And anybody gives you any crap, you know, just you come and see me directly. So I did, and I know the it was immediately we started 12-step programs all over the place, and it was working. We were getting them into treatment and doing a good job.
Let me ask you a question, Father. When you're doing all that stuff, I mean, what kind of joy did that bring your heart? Did you recognize it all? I mean, you knew you were doing exactly what you were supposed to do.
All I knew is I was on a mission, you know, and I didn't think about consequences, fame, glory, or nothing. You know, yeah. All I thought about was helping soldiers who were very much in need,
but feeling that you have a purpose too. I mean, that you knew you had the purpose, that drive. You know,
I knew. I knew again that I. You know, I'll never forget one of my officers. You have an officer's efficiency report that they write on you. I'll never forget what the commanding officer. Wrote in the opening lines of one of my officers' efficient report. He said, Father Holtberg's main purpose in the Army is to change the Army's attitude towards addiction. And I looked at that, I said, holy God, you talk about grandiosity. You know, but again, we did. You know, we got the attention of a lot of them. And I remember sitting in the officers' club with some high-ranking people, and we developed a residential treatment for the people out of Fort Bliss. Okay? So when I got back from Korea and I was assigned back to work in the hospital chaplain as well as the chaplain to the residential treatment facility at Fort Bliss, the William Beaumont Army Medical Center, and I can remember how great it was and the stuff that we're doing and whatnot. I got a call from the chief of chaplain's office about my second year there. About 83, I guess, and he said, Father, we hate to say this to you, but we're so short on Catholic priests, we can't afford to have a priest in specialized ministry. And he said, your career pattern for the next 10 years before you retire is going to be 18 months in the state, probably the only chaplain on the base like the Jewish people have. One Catholic priest per base, and you're going to circuit ride. And then you're going 2 to 3 years in Germany, circuit riding. Mm-hmm. And then back to the States for 18 months, 2 years in Alaska, circuit riding. And then 2 years, then Korea for a year or more and whatnot. And I said, I got to pray on this. And I came to the conclusion, what a waste of time. You know, I mean, Jesus, a sacramental mass dispenser, you just drive from place to place. Like, you know, the old circuit riders that went on horseback from one mm-hmm. location to another and whatnot. And it just rubbed me the wrong way. And then I found my other option was to resign my Army commission, a regular, and pick up a reserve commission. And that's what I decided to do. I came back, resigned my Army commission, came back. I thought, well, I'm going to work in the field at this time. And all of a sudden, one of the Jesuits here retired, and they were looking for another priest. And I applied and got it. So
When you say here, you mean Karen?
Karen, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. And so I started off as a therapist in 1984, I guess it was. And then 3 years later, I took over the job as chaplain. And they didn't know what. Nobody had chaplains in the drug and alcohol field at that time. And they said, that, but they were beginning to see the need for some spiritual care, spiritual direction. The field was again moving in that direction. Yeah. And they said, well, create a program. And so again, I use my military experience. Okay? I'm the only one here, and by that time we had 100 or more patients, whatever it was. And I use my military experience. And two of the most that I was trained when I went through the Navy's chaplain school back in '65, preparing us for ministry in Vietnam. It was called the Southern Methodist developed this program, and they came to teach us Navy and Marine Corps chaplains. It was called the Intensive Encounter and the Ministry of Presence, okay? And I can remember, it means that you're going to be all over the place, and people come to you, you're going to have to handle that as quickly as you possible and come up with some solution, okay? It's called the Intensive Encounter, and then just be seen all over the place. So that's basically what I did here, help the therapy staff see patients and come up with something, give them, and begin to have services here on Sunday. And then the Ministry of Presence, just be seen and make my rounds of the mess halls and where they were hanging out during breaks and stuff like that. So then we developed the service. We still had our retreat house here, and I was living here, and the patients would come across the streets, and we had a chapel up here. And I knew that the service had to be different. And so, again, it was what I thought was, instead of the sermon, I'm just going to have what the AA 12 steps said, one addict sharing with another, something magical happens. A, that we were addicts and could not manage our life. No human power could have really, God could and would if he were shot, saw it. And that meant that people on their own had to develop and discover a power greater than the addiction, say, and then one addict sharing with another could do it. And I said, well, they don't need me to preach at them. Why don't we bring them up and let them share, you know, what progress they were making, what problems they were having, and going for help. And that's how we started the service with up here. And then it continued to really grow and whatnot. So, am I making any sense to you?
You're making all the sense in the world to me, Father. I don't know. You know, it's funny. Thanks for asking, but absolutely, you are. I've been captivated listening to your story up to this point.
You know? Well, anyway, about 1989, I guess Foundation began to talk about treating adolescents. And I can remember us talking about should we make them go to church or not, how are we going to handle the spiritual part of this program, how they had the God issue, God could and would if he were there and saw it, and whatnot. And then we're going to have to treat I'm the only priest here. I'm going to have to be ministering to people of all denominations or no denominations. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had to, I had an awful lot of problems, and I prayed on it a lot, but, you know, how are we going to make things meaningful for the kids? So it just by, you know, you talk about God's hand in this. God sent us a rock group called Aerosmith. I'm not breaking any anonymity because they have already given me permission to say this was 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they were a godsend here. And I was the therapist for one of them in any way. And they didn't impress me at all. And I didn't know that how I would get involved with them at all at that particular
right.
time. So I remember one Saturday night about 11:30, I got a call. And when I get a call at 11:30, I think it's an emergency. And Father Bill, yeah, Joey. Joey who? Joey Kramer. Joey, where are you? He said, we got a gig in Philly. Why don't you come down? I said, Joey, I don't even like your music. I said, and believe me, there's no fool like an old fool. You're not going to get me in that spectrum with 22,000 freaky pot-smoking kids. You know? He said, Father, we'll take care of you. There's a lot of older people get there, and we just like to see you again. So, you know, it was like my program kicked in, like keep an open mind. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to get on. I had my dungarees on, my leather jacket, my cowboy boots and whatnot. And I walked in, and they put me on the soundboard and there. And and when the band come on, of course, all hell broke loose. But I wasn't tracking the band. I was tracking 22,000, I thought, freaky pot-smoking kids. Mm-hmm. My mouth flew open. And you talk about an experience there, and I'm saying, that band, every eye was on that band, and, you know, every what was going in those eyes and going in the ears. I said, oh, my God, where did we lose this generation? Mm-hmm. It was obvious to me at that moment that the most important training or experience that the kids were going was not from the school, not from the churches, you know, not from their community, say, but what was going in those ears and what they were seeing in those eyes. It was music was their medium. Mm-hmm. And I said, if we're going to get to the kids, it's got to be on their terms. Remember, I came back, and I guess it was another year or two, but I kept mauling, what are we going to do with the kids? And sure enough, we had our first group of kids coming in, and they were bitching about going to church. And I kept saying, look, I sat down with that first group. I said, look, I'll make a deal with you. Okay, you trust me, and I'll trust you. I said, to make this meaningful for you, I said, I will play your music under two conditions. It has a spiritual message and a recovery message to it. You're kidding me, Father Bill. I said, no, I'm not kidding you. And I said, you kids will pick out the music and give it to me. Okay? And the first two songs that we played at Mass when the kids were here was A Touch of Grey and Brothers and Sisters by the Grateful Dead. You can't get any more Christian, or we are brothers and sisters, you know. And The Touch of Grey was about a kid, again, who committed suicide. And well, but the thing was, Father Bill plays the Grateful Dead at church. Okay? And then after that, it was discovering that these kids had a lot of musical talent, you know. And so I can remember they were strumming their guitars over there, and I said, son, you got a lot of talent here. You know what I'd like you to do is to play a song at church. And they said, well, what, you know, I said, as long as it's got a spiritual message and a recovery message. And they began then playing at church. And then the other thing was, if I saw they got a lot of talent, remember one kid looking at his background and his musical talent, I said, I'd write right into his treatment plan, you are to create and perform a recovery song at every Sunday at church. And they did. You know, and that's how began this whole thing about bringing the music ministry in and incorporating them and getting back in touch with their higher power. And they could even get up at church and say, I'm looking for a higher power, you know, and I'm questioning, and can you people help me if anybody's got some ideas and whatnot? And there's some of the things that we threw around. And so I don't know where to go from here, but that's basically we're still at 81. I'm still working every day, about 10 hours a day, and thoroughly loving it. And the kids seem to be getting, well, you know, when the kids begin saying and writing home, the parents can't believe it. You know, the best. They look forward to Sunday morning going to church.
Yeah,
the parents are saying, "You said what? You said what?" And the thing is, the secret is that we've made it meaningful for those kids.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And the other thing too is that we've got a lot of, using the AA 12-step principles. Nobody will ever get beat up in our rooms. We'll take the people nobody else wants, you know, and that everybody is welcome. And so again, that's my opening remarks. Love and tolerance is our new attitude. You know, we don't tolerate intolerance or putting anybody down or name calling. We'll take you just as you are. And if at Mass on Sunday, those of you who are not Catholic and want to get up and share your belief system, feel free. I'm a Jew, and this is what we believe. Say, I'm a Muslim. This is what I'm Native American. I'm Buddhist. And they do. You know, one of the most powerful Masses we ever had here was right after 9/11. And I saw the three kids coming up on the side. I usually line them up on each side, and then they come up one at a time to share. And the three of them came up at one time. They were carrying books. And I didn't know, I haven't the faintest idea what's going to take place on a Sunday morning. We just never plan anything, you know. These kids came up, lined up in front, and they put their books on one. And the first guy said, "I am a Jew, and I would like to read out of the Old Testament." He ran a passage. The next guy said, "I am a Christian. I'd like to read out of the New Testament." And the next guy said, "I'm Muslim, and I'd like to read a passage from the Quran." And he did. They put their books down, put their arms around one another, and said, "Why can't we all get along?" Mm-hmm. And man, it brought the house down. You know,
absolutely.
And I said, this is what it's about. And I say, too, is, you know, that why every war out there is a religious war. In the name of God, we're killing one another.
Yeah.
You know, in the name of God, you know, why can't we see the goodness in one another's belief system rather than the things that divide us, the things that unite us? And I'm back to an enlisted man over in Korea. Or over in Japan, up at Miyajima, watching that Korean or that Japanese woman, and I can't believe she's gone to hell because she doesn't believe like me, you know?
Absolutely.
And I began to see the goodness in other people. May the bonds that unite us be stronger than those things that divide us, and we shall survive. And I truly believe that's the message, the spiritual part of the 12-step programs. Whatever 12-step program it is, you know, we have got a life, we've got a spiritual message to change this world. And I treat that spiritual message needs to be taken back into our churches. Okay, needs to be taken back into our churches, because again, it's too many of our. And I just scratched my head and said, you know, I don't know what the churches are anymore. We know what they're against. I'm not too sure what they're for anymore. You know, in the name of God, we're killing one another. Okay? But I'm seeing the beauty of the 12-step programs. We take people just as they are, and not as they should be.
Well, you know, I hear the passion. I hear the passion in your voice. You know, that could be a whole nother show. You know, and I want to say that first of all, I mean, I really appreciate you taking the time. You're a hard man to track down. I had to be a little tenacious. You're very busy, and I didn't know how old you were, but you're going strong. In your story, I heard a lot of, you know, a lot of hope and a lot of. You mentioned the children right away, and do you see how good God's grace is that your path almost like unfolded almost so you couldn't hardly miss it a lot of times, you know? I mean, you participate in it, but you stayed on the path, you know, the whole time.
Well, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself.
Yeah, you know, that's so cool.
The trail there.
Listen,
I could die tomorrow being fulfilled.
Huh? Do you want to mention how, do you want to put out there how anybody can contact you, or how they can contact Karen, or where the church is?
Yeah, the Karen number is 1-800-678-2332. And if you need questions about, you know, people trying to get into the program, getting treatment, or just ask for me, and they'll put you through to my office phone number here. But people who need treatment, we got an awesome treatment program here for adults and kids. We got an awesome breakthrough program here for codependency and whatnot. We got the full gala of treatment here, and I'm excited to get to work every day because we're seeing families back together again.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
what do you want to leave? If you can sum it up, what do you want to leave the listeners with? If you have to tell somebody anything, where they are in their life, if they're not following their dream, if they're struggling with anything, what's the message I hope you want to leave us with?
The message I would like to see is there's no other disease where misinformation or a lack of it will kill you. And those of you, again, had better learn who see addiction in the family, whether it's medically prescribed drugs, say, or illegal drugs, or legal drugs, you know, like alcohol and cigarettes are the two legal drugs that are killing more than anybody else in here. And, you know, that kind of look us up, and if you need treatment, and even say if we can't, we'll refer you to the proper treatment facilities mm-hmm. that you do need here. See? So we're really expanding. No longer just drug and alcohol. You know, addiction is addiction. Right. And we're doing an awful lot of work here in all fields of addiction. But putting that family back together again is important. An untreated addict is not capable of having an intimate, lasting relationship with themselves, others, the universe, and God. They cannot have a happy marriage because they can't have that intimacy there. And the divorce rate is just skyrocketing.
That'll do it for this show. Father Bill, what a great, great opportunity to hear his story. So until next week, remember, dream big and make it a great day.